Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, you can call this number now, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our calls, what are our topics this time?
We're going to talk about teens and protein shakes. Are they good for them? Do they actually produce more muscles in young teenagers, boys and girls who want muscles? And what does that mean for their body self-image?
And
we're going to talk about creativity and mental illness. Is there really a link? And what does that mean for you?
Interesting. What's our recipe?
Cuban black bean soup.
This coming from a guest chef and author later on in the hour. Again, that number is 800-462-7413. To the phones we go, Zorba, and a listener in Trenton, New Jersey. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I have a 18-year-old daughter who's a freshman in college and sent her to school very healthy and in shape. And when we moved her into her dorm room, I smelled a funky smell in her room and just put it aside that it was a dorm room. Mm-hmm. And then about 3-4 weeks into school, she started to get sick with coughing and sinus trouble. And sent her to their doctor on campus who tested her for mono and a couple different things and all came up negative. Every time she'd go back into the room, she would get sick again. And so do you know what could be causing her symptoms and how do we get her healthy again?
Oh, sure. So she's in college. She's in a dorm. Okay. First of all, a lot of dorms are not new dorms; they're older dorms. But the first thing we always think about is sick building syndrome. That's always number one on there. If you smell something and it's musty and it doesn't seem exactly right, or it's an older dorm and it's not at home, it's kind of the first thing that we go to. But in fact, that's probably not the cause of her illness. The most likely cause of her illness is really what my wife and I used to call kennel cough, and it's from being around other people, and you like that term, don't you?
Yeah.
Stuck
see,
in.
See,
like
it took a while.
Dogs.
It's kennel cough. That's what it is. She's surrounded by all these other young puppies, and they're all in there in the dorm, and they go from room to room. I mean, if you've lived in a dorm like I did, you know, you're in your jammies, and you're going from one room to the other, and you're actually in close contact, and so things spread through the dorms.
What if nobody else is sick in the dorm, and she does have a sink in her room?
Yeah. Well, what is your daughter say? Does she want to move to a different dorm?
Well, no, she loves her friends
and
has a great roommate
and
would love to stay there, but it seems she hasn't been staying in the room. She's been staying with friends now because she's been out of the room. So it'd be a lot nicer to be able to stay because you have a camaraderie with everybody in the dorm.
Exactly. And this, when we look at the data of sick building syndrome, and I don't mean new buildings that actually have often formaldehyde in the air and other things, but sick buildings from mold, the data is very, very sketchy. You know, mold that you can see on the wall, we know we have to get rid of that because it's not good for allergies and not good for a whole bunch of other things. But people live in older buildings and often don't necessarily get sick. So from your daughter's point of view, what I would do is I would look at how to build up her immune system for this. So number one, you know, making sure the room is as clean as the room can possibly be. That's one thing that's in there. Sometimes people will add ion exchangers, and these actually make the dust stick to the wall versus in the air. And you can buy them. They're ionizers, and they cost about $25. You plug it into the wall, and the dust, if you look at the wall, the dust actually sticks to the wall. So it gets rid of a lot of the dust in the room. Having a fan that can blow in the room can make a difference so that there's air exchange, keeping a window open in the room all the time can all make a difference for that. From your daughter's point of view, having Purell on her hands and just using it a bit more. And like you said, the others are not as sick, but sometimes they may still spread it. And also, she may be in close contact with other people who are not simply in the immediate, you know, part of the dorm because she's seen people around school. And I have four kids, and they didn't tell me everything that went on in college. That much I know, because I didn't tell my parents everything that went around in college, too.
Oh, come on, yeah.
I never had anything that I worried about telling anybody about.
Yeah, yeah.
I had the dullest college life.
Yeah, you know something, Tom, dullest, and maybe a little memory loss in there also.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks so much. Thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, we appreciate the call. We're having windows put in, and we can smell something different with all the insulation and the new stuff. Yeah. And I'm kind of stuffed up today, I'm sure that has something to do with
I'm sure it does. Because there are the chemicals in the air, and the best thing
sawing
leave it
boards
open.
And
there's
stuff.
Sawing, and there's dust, and there's chemicals, and there are a number of things in the air that we don't know. But good air movement can often get rid of these things. And there is a sick building syndrome.
We used to hear about that all the time. You don't hear about that.
Well, you don't hear about it because the science actually disappeared. In other words, the smells that you have turn out to be smells and for the most part have not been proven to cause disease. So that's why it fell to the side. And part of this were lawyers. Lawyers were into it. They were trying to prove that it was worth a lot of money, get rid of the sick building syndrome. This person got this and that. They lost in court, and so the midnight advertisement for sick buildings kind of fell away.
And the lawyers can send their emails to
Zorba@WPR.org.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. On we go, Zorba, to a listener in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, Tom and Doc. It's so great to be talking with you today.
Yeah, what's up?
Yeah, my question is about, I think I have weird blood pressure. In the mornings, my blood pressure is very normal. In the afternoons, it gets up pretty high in the, say, 130s over 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to two general practice doctors, and they have differing opinions about it, and so I don't know what to do.
Well, let's hear their opinions.
Well, one says he thinks maybe it's kind of normal that people's blood pressure just goes up in the PM. I'm concerned that that is too high. And the other one says that I should go on to medication, and that's what I really want to avoid if possible.
How old are you?
43.
43. And family history, blood pressure in your family, heart disease?
Both parents do have hypertension. Mm-hmm. They went on medication in their 60s.
In their 60s, okay. Dietary indiscretion. Let's talk about your dietary indiscretions. Tom is smiling. He likes
that. I've never heard that term before.
I know.
It's a good one.
It's a new term. See, I can be creative.
Yes,
I can be creative.
Yes, absolutely.
Dietary indiscretions. Tell me about
a creative doctor.
tell me about your dietary indiscretions.
Now, Dr. Zorba, I'm a pastor, so we use that word carefully. One of the things I've discovered is if I have a large lunch, my blood pressure goes much higher in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
But I eat pretty well. I do lots of exercise, too. So I haven't really noticed a correlation between diet and that, except if I have a large lunch, it definitely goes up.
Would you have salty food during that lunch?
Sometimes, probably.
Sometimes. Okay. So a couple of different things. First of all, you may have high blood pressure. I mean, to me, it sounds like you're certainly on the border. I don't know which side of the border you're on. You have borderline pressure. If you do have high blood pressure medicines have been shown to be dynamite. They really work. The younger you're on, the more effective they are. We've reduced stroke by 70% in the last 3 decades because we treat high blood pressure aggressively and we treat it early. There is high normal blood pressure, which is not high blood pressure, and that's a diastolic above 85, in other words, between 85 and 90. Once you're at 90, you're at high blood pressure. Mm-hmm. And a systolic between 135 and 139. And that's roughly what it is. My recommendation is get a home monitor. Do you have a home monitor?
I don't.
Okay. Buy a home monitor. This will answer the question. Bring the machine in once to your doctor to make sure it's accurate. The newer ones are really pretty accurate. You got to spend $50 to get a good one. $25 ones do not work. Measure your pressures in the morning. Measure your pressures in the evening. Get a few other pressures. If they measure and they average above that normal range, the diastolic above 90, the systolic above 140, if they average that, then I would treat you. Now, if it's only the occasional reading, I fit on the side of not treating it at all. But if it turns out on a regular basis that number goes up to 90, you should be on medications. Now, then the next question is, you should be on medications. What can I do before medications? Alcohol, see if that's a factor. For some people, literally a drink a day can make a difference. For most people, it's got to be two or more drinks a day. And for other people, salt can be a factor. So you look at it and you just get rid of the salt in your diet and see what your pressure does. 70% of the people, salt is not a factor, a good 30 or 40%.
You're saying two or three drinks can help keep your blood pressure down?
No, I'm sorry. 2 to 3 drinks a day, excuse me, I misspoke, will elevate your pressure. So reduction, let me tell you, you can see where my brain is at. Indiscretion,
you're
obviously.
You're fine. I just didn't quite understand which one you were going.
But in other words, removing alcohol and salt might be a factor you can look at. Like you said, you exercise right now. But I would get a home meter because that's going to answer it. You're on the border, and if you stay high normal, you can just watch it, and a home meter is going to help you with this.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Sure, thank you, and keep us in your prayers.
Thank you.
I sure will.
We need all the help we can get.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
At 800-462-7413.
And I'll be careful of my use of that word indiscretion.
So, Zorba, teens are turning to protein shakes to pump up. So what?
That's right. Well, I think the so what is the big question. Mm-hmm. So, and this is kind of big news. If we look at teenagers who are exercising, first of all, it was very common, and it's still common, for high school athletes, for college students to exercise to try to buff their body. And the real question is, what's happening with teens and what's happening with middle schoolers? And what we're discovering is that over the last 5 and 10 years, men's magazines like Men's Journal and Men's Health, looking for the buff person who is genetically does not have subcutaneous fat on their body, so you can see the six-pack abs, mm-hmm. who works very, very hard, maybe two to three to four hours a day to try to pump up their body. What we're discovering is that this is now going down into middle school. And the question is, what does this do to the middle school body and body image of young boys who are 10, 11, and 12 are doing this? Now, the 15-year-olds and the 16-year-olds are using protein shakes. Protein shakes are fine. They're okay. Mm-hmm. They're soybean-based protein shakes. Do they do anything? Well, people who exercise and bodybuild say they really help their bodybuilding. And the data, you know, we don't have a lot of scientific data. No one's done scientific studies, but they use them, and there's nothing wrong. There is no downside. The issue is there a downside to overexercise for young men and women and young girls in terms of body image of the developing body? That's kind of the question.
So is there an issue?
Well, there's a proto-development before you become a teenager of who you think you are. And I think it is an issue. I think it's an issue not for all kids. You know, I see boys who are in eighth grade and they're strong and they're muscular, and then they'll be next to another boy whose pituitary hasn't started and they'll be 4'6". Yeah. And they may both be taking protein shakes and working on the same body, and they're just different bodies in development.
But is the young person doing any harm to his
or her body? I don't think that there's any evidence that they're doing any harm to their body by exercising, doing that. I think the question is mentally, what is going on with a child?
Feeling bad about the fact that you're too skinny. I'm talking about myself when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And working and not getting anywhere, and how that can play on your mind.
Exactly. And that's the real question. So I think protein shakes are fine. Mm-hmm. I think exercise for young boys and young girls are fine. I mean, getting them off their duff and off computer games and away from the TV is fine. It's better for the body and it's mm-hmm. useful. And the question is, what's too much? That's the bottom line question. And I think a parent has to be involved here, because teenagers are teenagers and their brain is not fully developed. I mean, I have a memory when I was a teenager, my brain wasn't fully developed. I mean, so you don't always make the right choices. And I think that's where parental involvement fits in.
Yeah. When is my brain going to be fully developed?
You know, when you're 90 years of age, I think it'll finally be fully developed.
1-800-462-7413. It's toll free. 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, a listener in Madison, Wisconsin, is with us. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my question.
We appreciate it. What is it?
Well, I have been seeing on the morning shows and Dr. Oz lately supplements. So the one of them is raspberry carotene,
mm-hmm. okay.
green coffee extract,
mm-hmm.
and resveratrol.
Mm-hmm.
And so I purchased some of them.
Uh-huh. How much did you spend?
More than I should.
More than you should. Very important. I always think that's an important point. When you're harping a supplement and you're making money, how good is that information? So please go on.
So, I noticed that it's not FDA approved.
Correct. FDA, on the whole, does not approve or disapprove of supplements. They are regulated like cosmetics. And there's some advantages and disadvantages to that, but they're not regulated like a drug. Mm-hmm.
Just curiosity, what was that supplement or those supplements supposed to do?
Regulate my metabolism to help me lose weight.
Okay. So let's look at weight loss supplements as a whole, and then what's the danger of that? By the way, a lot of people spend lots of money on supplements. They're hot, and they've been hot forever. Mm-hmm. Resveratrol, which is really a derivative of grape, we've thought may help heart disease. The data on it has really been not very good. You know, red wine is much better probably than resveratrol, and that's where the data is. And there are a number of people who are in the resveratrol market, and they make good money. Green coffee is the latest hot supplement. Let's take green coffee extract. It'll lose weight and increase your metabolism and work. And let's put it this way. We are a fat country. Fat is not a word we like to use. It's an insulting word. So we use the word obese. And I've had a number of patients who've said, well, obese is insulting also. So overnourished. Well, overnourished is sort of the PC way of saying it. But we eat too much and we weigh too much, which is sort of the, I think, the neutral way to say it. And there's no easy method. Nothing has been shown to pop up your metabolism that you take that will make you burn more calories other than exercise, period. And so what happens is we have supplements that say, well, this will move your metabolism, burn calories. There is never any scientific evidence of it because, in fact, there's no science behind it because they don't do it. It doesn't actually work. And if it worked, you'd be able to take a supplement, you'd be able to take a vitamin, and all of a sudden everyone in the country would not be overweight anymore. So I don't believe in this stuff. I don't think it works at all. And what happens is there's a churning. There's a new one every day. And so Dr. Oz, who I think is really, really good and does a lot of good stuff, but he'll mention a supplement. The stock will go up in that company. You know, millions of people will try it. And then 2 months later, when they don't lose weight, they'll try another one. So the bottom line, I think, is supplements don't cause weight loss. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. We appreciate the call. And Zorba, before we take a short break, time now for you to offer up another double dose of 4-cent advice. This week, Kathy in Buffalo, New York, needs some help smoothing out the wrinkles in her doc's diagnosis. Kathy recently began drinking fruit smoothies to stay healthy, but found that her cholesterol actually went up. She visited the cardiologist, who blamed the smoothies. Kathy insisted it was because she recently stopped taking her cholesterol meds, but the doc still ordered a smoothie sabbatical. So Kathy asks, can a daily fruit smoothie really ruin my cholesterol? I know your answer to this one.
Go ahead, answer it. Go ahead, go for it.
You stop taking the medicine, the
right.
cholesterol goes
Excellent.
Up. Let's blame the fruit smoothie.
Right. Well, you got Dr. Tom's answer there. And so you can write him at tom@wbr.org.
If you suspect someone of framing the fruit or just want a second take on your doc's 2 cents, send your thoughts along in an email to
Zorba@wbr.org.
We have a guest recipe coming up. You'll want to stay tuned for that. It's vegetarian. Lots more of your calls, our medical myth buster later, another topic to talk about. Lots of great reasons for you to stick around here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. Callers are waiting, but we have an open line for you at 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, our recipe, looking forward to this one. Guest chef is with us. We welcome blogger and author Lindsay Nixon onto the show. Lindsay takes well-known recipes and creates healthier vegan versions. Her new cookbook is called Happy Herbivore Abroad and was inspired by food from all over the world. Our recipe today is for Cuban black bean soup. And even though Lindsay never adds extra fats to her food, I've been told that they can still taste good. So, Lindsay, welcome.
Hi.
Glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. What made you decide to go vegan?
I adopted a plant-based diet about 5 years ago, and about a year before that, I had a serious health scare in my early 20s, and I decided to become a vegetarian, basically just removing meat and fish from my diet. And then after I started doing more research, I decided to eliminate all animal products from my diet and adopt, you know, a totally vegan, plant-based diet. And most of my motivations were for health, but, you know, I was also kind of motivated by the environmental benefits and, you know, the plight of farm animals. So it's kind of a multi-leg thing for me, I guess.
Yeah, you're married. Did you have trouble dragging your husband along on this?
When I went vegetarian, my husband was like, sure, okay, well, I'll eat vegetarian at home, but I'm going to do what I want when I'm in the, you know, restaurant, et cetera. And I said, fine. When I went totally vegan, plant-based, he's like, you're on your own. So that's when I learned how to cook.
I was waiting
and,
for that.
I think I was plant-based for about a year when my husband just came home one day and he's like, I don't want you to get too excited, but I've been vegetarian for 30 days. And I about, you know, fell off because I never saw what he was eating outside of the house. So I didn't know what he was doing at lunch. And then once, you know, he did the little bit, I kind of nudged him along. But, you know, he loves it. He's probably a bigger advocate than I am. And then my parents converted in January of this year, and my sister's on board. So we're kind of a, like, plant-based family now.
Yeah. And now you're going for our entire audience.
I love it.
Dragging them along with you.
I love it. I love it. Well, certainly when we look at it from an environmental point of view in the production of protein, if we, and I'm an omnivore, and I'm a committed omnivore, so I'll be an omnivore. But when I look at animal products, of course, and how much energy it takes and how much land we use, it's very obvious that plant-based is better. And actually, when you look at traditional food and societies where people can eat well, in other words, they have enough protein, they don't use large amounts of animal products. They use small amounts of animal products, and we in the U.S. just use lots of animal products that lead to that.
Right. It's really surprising when I was traveling abroad to see that, you know, this tiny little, you know, basically the size of one hamburger in the U.S. is the meat that they used for the whole family versus here, you know, you have the hamburger and the chicken and the bacon. It's all together and for one person. So it's very much more meat saturated in America for sure.
Right. Very, very much so. So we're going to do the soup and then I want to talk a little bit about this cookbook, which I find really interesting. So this is Cuban black bean soup. Where'd you get it from?
Well, I grew up in Tampa, Florida, which has a very heavy Cuban influence from its, you know, rich history. And I always ate Cuban black bean soup as a kid, and it was a comfort food for me. And then one day I came across a recipe for a vegetarian version of Cuban black bean soup. And then I kind of tweaked it a little bit to make it vegan and plant-based and also taste more similar to the black bean soup that I grew up eating, like specifically Cuban kind. And so that's basically how I developed it.
I think it's a great recipe. What I like about this recipe is I can keep everything in my house, and if I want to make a quick soup, I can make this as a quick soup. And I like having stuff around the house because if friends stop by or my kids come home or something, I like to make a good, tasty soup with variation and just have the stuff there. And I make lots of soups. So let's make this Cuban black bean soup. So we start out with one small onion chopped. Any specific onion you use or just any onion around the house?
I generally use whatever onions laying around the house. But,
good.
You know, if you want to be really traditional, maybe use like a small sweet onion, like the, you know, yellowish one.
Yeah, I always have a variety of the onions. And what I try to use is the one that isn't growing the green sprouts out of the onion that's moldy. That's the one that I try not
that's
that I try.
One. The one that's not moldy, too, is also a good choice.
It's actually, that is the good choice. Tom liked that. Liked it. 1.5 teaspoons of chili powder. Now, when you say chili powder, you mean hot chili powders that we're talking about? What sort of chili powder?
No, just like the regular chili powder. It says chili powder right on the label.
And it's 1.5 teaspoons. So this is chili powder that we use to make chili con carne. Okay. 1 tablespoonful of ground cumin seed, 15-ounce can of black beans drained and rinsed. And the more you rinse beans that come out of the can, the less gas you will have. And gas is always an issue in a close-knit society, right?
Well, and also, too, if you don't buy, like, the no-salt beans, rinsing them is great because it gets off the excess sodium, too.
Right, which is quite good. 1.5 cups of veggie broth. Low-sodium veggie broth is generally what I look for. 1/4 teaspoon of prepared salsa. Fresh salsa?
No, it's a quarter cup.
A quarter cup, excuse me. Is it a fresh salsa that you use, or what kind of salsa do you use?
I usually have, like, a jar of salsa either in my pantry or if it's been opened in my fridge, and that's what I use.
Sounds great. 1.5 teaspoons of lime juice. Always go for the fresh stuff if you've got limes in. I usually have limes in my refrigerator.
Yeah, I always have lime in my fridge.
Yeah. 2 tablespoonfuls of fresh cilantro if you're the non-cilantro.
Which is optional.
And that's optional because some people love it and some people don't. And I often will substitute parsley for cilantro if I have somebody, guest coming over, and I know they don't like it. It doesn't add the same flavor, but it's green. 1 to 2 green onions sliced for garnish, some corn chips for garnish, and hot sauce or cayenne peppers.
Yeah, so the chili powder and the hot sauce or cayenne pepper, that's what makes this dish for me.
That's what makes it for you. So
yeah, I drizzle so much Tabasco sauce right on top, which is beautiful. It looks so fancy with the little, you know, the black soup with the red drizzle, but I'm like you guys, I just love the heat.
Yeah, the heat is really good. So line a skillet with a little bit of either water or veggie broth. Saute the onion overheat until translucent, about 2 to 3 minutes. Add the chili powder and cumin. Stir it to combine it. Add beans, veggie broth, and salsa. Bring to a boil, then reduce to low. Simmer for 10 minutes. Remove from the heat, then stir in the lime juice. Important to put the lime juice in after. Transfer half the mixture to the blender and puree it. I love that as a concept because it's only half, so it's not going to be totally pureed. Mix the puree in back in the scoop and then garnish with cilantro, green onion, broken tortilla chips, drizzle of the hot and cayenne pepper. Fabulous. And two things that stick out on this recipe, which is, first of all, it's 44% of the protein you need for the day.
Wow.
So if you're – wow, that's exactly it. So if you're talking about a high-protein shake, which is what people talk about, this is a high-protein soup.
Right, because it's all beans.
And the other thing is you cut out the oil by not sautéing the onion in fat. And so the fat is, you know, is minimal in this. So I think this is a dynamite recipe. I really like it. And by the way, I like the cookbook that you have, which is The Happy Herbivore Abroad. We're going to put it on our website. We're going to give that website in
just a minute.
But I like it because I like the fact that there are pictures. I like everything on one page, and it's from all over the world. And then there's some dorky pictures of you in the cookbook that I think about you standing in front of some famous picture somewhere in the world. And I love dorky photos, so I want to thank you for putting in the dorky photo.
I put a lot of myself in my books because my previous two books, it's just like recipes.
But I
traveled for so long to write this book. I was like, I'm going to throw in some of the pictures of my travels. People can laugh at me.
That's exactly. Dorky photos sell. So I think it's a good, it's good sell. Thank you so much.
I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Lindsay. To get a copy of today's recipe or to find out more about Lindsay's latest book, Happy Herbivore Abroad, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
+1 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba, and a listener with us in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, what I'm calling about is I've been having this issue that started about a year and a half ago, and it's gotten significantly worse in the last probably 6 months. When I wake up, my fingers are so stiff that I can hardly bend them, and I can't pick up a cup of coffee. I can't do anything. I just had carpal tunnel surgery and had hoped that that would help, but it has not made any difference whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. This is on just one hand or both hands?
No, it's on both.
Well, you had carpal tunnel surgery because you had symptoms, right?
Correct, yes, and had the testing and everything.
Uh-huh. That's it. Yes. That's a different issue. Okay, so that issue was taken care of. How old are you?
I'm 56.
Oh, you only sound like you're 39. You sound so much younger. You sound so much younger. And when you get up in the morning, your other joints ache too?
No, just my hands.
Your hands. What do you do? How long does it take for your hand ache to go away, to get better?
The thing that works the best, actually, is like if I put my hands in a bowl of warm water, almost hot water.
Yeah. How long does it take to go away in the morning?
You know, it never completely goes away. Mm-hmm. It's still, the stiffness still persists, but it's manageable and I can go about my daily activities. But the worst part of it takes probably about a half hour, I would say.
Uh-huh.
And even if I don't do anything with it, it'll be gone in a half hour.
It'll be gone in a half an hour. Okay, so there are a couple of things. I mean, this is a form of arthritis. I mean, it's not the carpal tunnel. You hoped it would go away and hope springs eternal, but often joints have a life and a mind of their own. So the question is whether or not it's osteoarthritis, which is the most common arthritis, most common as we get older, or rheumatoid arthritis, which is a much more serious arthritis. And osteoarthritis usually goes away in about 30 minutes. People get better. Often there are other joints that are involved, but sometimes it's just the joints in the hands in the morning, and that would be the most likely diagnosis for this. You can't tell without a full evaluation, but it sounds like OA, osteoarthritis. You take anything when you go to sleep at night, any anti-inflammatories?
Well, occasionally. A couple ibuprofen.
I'll tell you what I would try. What I would do is every night before I went to sleep, I would take two naproxen, over-the-counter Aleve tablets, generic, just as good as the name brand. I'd pop two of them every single night for about 6 weeks. See what that does. And see whether or not you feel better in the morning. And the reason why I mention it is I have a little osteoarthritis, and I have back pain. And since I take two Aleve tablets, and I take over-the-counter Aleve, just like I suggest others, I don't wake up in the morning with a backache. I wake up in the morning feeling just chipper. And then I've done the usual experiments of stopping the Aleve to see whether or not I feel chipper. And the answer is no, I feel achy. Now, when I get up in the morning, I still ache, but I don't ache as much. And it takes me about a half an hour to kind of work off my ache, and then by a half an hour, I know it's gone. But the naproxen helps me so I'm not as bothered by it. And so if you find it works for you, I would do it. But I give it a six-week trial to see if it works.
Awesome. Okay. Oh, that sounds fantastic. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for the call.
We appreciate it. On we go, Zorba, to La Crosse, Wisconsin now. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, about 7 months ago, I had some kind of an insect bite that appeared on my knee, and in the course of the next week or so, it got inflamed and infected, which ultimately was then diagnosed as cellulitis and lymphangitis, and went on a couple trips to the emergency room and went on a strong course of antibiotics for 10 days, and it seemed to clear up. However, the tightness in my groin around the lymph node and where that was swollen has never really gone away. And I'm wondering, you know, is that normal? Or what would be some complications maybe of some kind of an infection like this that could be happening?
Uh-huh. So 7 months ago, you had this infection. Sometimes it takes a long time for lymph nodes to settle down and to get better. But the node is still swollen at this time. Is it red and hot and swollen or just swollen?
Just swollen. Definitely not red and hot.
Uh-huh. Does it bother you or is it just something you notice?
It bothers me. It's, you know, I've gone to the doctor several times.
What'd your doc say?
They're really not sure, and the latest diagnosis was potentially it's some kind of a muscle strain in my lower abdomen groin area, and I've been taking some anti-inflammatories. Uh-huh.
But do you feel an actual lymph node? Do you feel a little nubbin of something there, like a bean-sized lymph node or not?
Yep. Yes, I do.
Uh-huh. Well, I've got some suggestions. First of all, the real question is if the lymph node is bothering you, should they just remove the lymph node and get it out of there? And is that going to get rid of the pain? That's kind of the question. I mean, we worry about lymph nodes when there's no explanation as to why they're swollen, but you have an explanation. You had an infection. And after an infection, quite often people experience pain, and it can continue for a fairly long period of time. Lymphangitis, which is an infection that starts somewhere else and goes up the lymphatic system, can be very, very painful, as you know, and uncomfortable. You made a few trips to the ER. If I were you, what I would do is I would let it be and I wouldn't touch it for another 3 or 4 months. I often give things a year afterwards to see if they settle down. And if they don't settle down at the end of a year, I'd go to your doc and say, look, this lymph node is driving me nuts. I want to get it taken out. I'd like to have it checked to make sure there isn't anything there, because you could have a smoldering infection in that lymph gland. I mean, it could actually be there if it still bothers you a year later. If it's not red, not hot, not terribly tender, it's doubtful there's an infection, but sometimes a few rogue bacteria hang out in the node and cause the problem.
Okay.
Give it time. Try not to play with it. You know, when we have something that bothers us, yeah. You know what I mean? Sometimes sure. We kind of play with it. Is it still there? Is it still there? Well, it is still there. And the more we touch it sometimes, the more we irritate it. So if you can get your mind away from it, so you're not checking it several times a day, which is what I would do if I had it, yeah. You know, it might have a chance to settle down and get rid of your discomfort.
I've been pretty good about not playing with it because it seems to aggravate it.
So you know what I mean.
Yes, I do.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Sure, we appreciate it. What are you doing? I'm playing with my nymph.
My lymph node. Is that why your hand is there fiddling around? No, but you know what I mean. What happens is you do things like that where you all of a sudden touch something to see if it's still there.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Nature. Before we take another short break, Zorba, time to dust off your black robe for another episode of Judge Zorba.
Oh, I'm excited.
Today's case comes to us from a listener named Steve, who's afraid that he may be skimming over the facts. Steve writes, "Hello, Zorba. For years, I've purchased skim milk for my family with the conventional wisdom that skim milk is the best. Now, some sources say that I shouldn't worry about the saturated fat in natural products like milk, only in things like a Snickers bar. Some people say that even whole milk will not harm you at all. Now I'm puzzled. Can you help?"
Absolutely. I'm going to come right down on saturated fat is saturated fat is saturated fat.
Even if it's in milk.
Of course. I mean, I'm from Wisconsin, where not drinking milk is akin to communism. You know, I mean, it's a terrible thing. But the reality is saturated animal fat or saturated fat of any sort, like mm-hmm. trans fat, is bad for you. And reducing saturated fat is important. Now, just because the product is natural, well, a cow is natural. Yeah. And actually, any fat we get is natural. It comes from somewhere. It's not a petroleum-based product. So the answer is saturated fat is bad. Unsaturated fat is good. Too much unsaturated fat is bad. Milk with sort of a natural, if you will, impression on it does not make the natural fat go away.
So skip with the skim.
Stay with the skim.
Yeah, stay, not skip.
Stay. Well, you can go skipping with the skim, but stay with the skim.
Skip the whole, stay with the skim.
That's right.
Want to give Zorba another chance to milk his role as magistrate?
Oh.
Send your case to Judge Zorba in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
An interesting topic is coming up. More of your calls are Medical Mythbuster 2 here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, more evidence linking creativity with mental illness.
Right. And, you know, this link, this possible link, this is a study of it, has been wondered about for quite some time. You look at Van Gogh, yeah. And, you know, he clearly had mental illness, committed suicide, did, you know, strange things like cutting off his ear prior to that, was suffering,
yeah.
And was, you know, one of the world's great, you know, great.
You hear
painters.
About it with other creative
You hear
people,
about it. And so they looked at 1.2 million Swedish psychiatric patients, mm-hmm. And they looked at bipolar disorder very, very specifically and found that artistic people, people who went into professions like dancers, photographers, authors, researchers, were much more likely to suffer from bipolar disorder, but also more likely to suffer from schizophrenia, depression, anxiety, and were more likely to be involved in substance abuse. And so it's really the first long-term study where they actually did a fact-finding study to see if there was a connection.
A pretty important study. A lot of people they looked at.
A lot of people that they looked at, and then they compared it to the regular population. And so the questions here that they really wanted to ask was, if we began intervening earlier, if we did, for instance, we looked at dancers, photographers, people who are creative, and started then doing a health inventory to see if they're suffering from depression and bipolar disorder and treated them, would we actually help save them? Because they're twice as likely to actually commit suicide as the general population.
The big question is why? Why are creative?
Well, I don't think we know where that connection is. Why does that happen? Maybe when you're unhappy, you begin to look at ways to get out of your unhappiness. Maybe there's some sort of a connection between the creative gene. I don't think anyone really knows why.
Yeah, maybe you're never satisfied.
You're never satisfied, so you're looking for a way to improve your life and improve the world. In either case, this connection is there, and I think what we have to do is look at creative people and say, well, creativity may be a marker for mental illness. Maybe we should step in.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Back to the phone, Zorba, and a listener now in Bozeman, Montana. Hi.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
I have a question for Zorba. I have a bump on my finger. It's on the palm side of my finger. I've had it now for maybe about a year and a half. And it's only painful when I push on it.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a little bit of research on it, and I was thinking it might be a ganglion cyst, possibly also known as a Gideon cyst.
I don't think no one calls it a Gideon cyst. I think it's called a ganglion cyst. I've never heard that, but that's in the net. Sounds sort of biblical. You haven't shown it to a medical professional like your doctor.
I have not.
Right. So it does sound like a ganglion. Ganglion is a bit of fluid in the joint, and that there's a little rent in the joint, kind of bubbles up. And there's some interesting ways to treat it. When I first started practicing 50 years ago, 50, 75 years ago. not quite that
long. But who's counting?
But I had a medical book that I got from old Dr. Kellogg, and he came into our town in 1949, and that was an old book at that time. It was a book like from the 30s or 40s, which I have since misplaced. And they gave the treatment for the ganglionic cyst at the time, which was to take the family Bible, put the wrist up here, take the end of the family Bible and smash your hand so that you would smash the cyst. And then they talked about how to deal with the pain afterwards.
That's where the Gideon cyst comes
from. Oh, you know what? And maybe that's it. I never thought about that. I really used the Bible. That's where it came from, because it talked about using the family Bible.
I do have an interesting tidbit on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did attempt that. However, I used an Encyclopedia Britannica.
You see, that was your problem.
And after I picked myself up on the floor, I managed to give me a good whack a second time and decided I was going to probably break my finger with that method.
That's probably exactly what would happen. And then you used the wrong book.
Yeah. That was the wrong thing. I didn't have the power of the Lord with me there.
So, getting on to the more scientific treatments, first of all, you need somebody to look at it to see if it is a ganglion. Sometimes we freeze the top of it, put a needle in it, pull the fluid out, which is kind of a thick fluid. It almost looks like grease. Put a little steroid in it. Quite often that'll get rid of it once or twice, one injection or two injections. And if that fails and it bothers you, sometimes people will have surgery for them. And sometimes they go away on their own. And I think not trying this a second time traumatically is in your best interest. So.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you for finally clearing up the whole Bible and the naming of the Gideon cyst, ganglion cyst. I will think of you every time I see someone in my office with a ganglion.
Thank you so much.
so much.
Thanks. We appreciate the call. Can't get rid of this image of banging your sister with a book.
With an Encyclopedia Britannica. It was the wrong book.
Zorba, before we get back to the phones, time again for our medical myth buster now. This week we need you to deal with the commonly held belief that a broken bone will heal to be stronger than it was before. So, Zorba, is this myth bona fide?
No, bona fide. I love it. It is false. Oh. It is not bona fide. What happens is when you break a bone, the body puts scaffolding all around the bone, and little osteoblasts come in, and they produce a lot of calcium. Mm-hmm. And the bone is not that strong for a while. It takes probably 12 weeks for the bone really to mend. But after it mends, you've got something called callus, which is around it, and you've got this, you know, little scaffolding. So after it's fully mended, maybe for a little while it might be stronger than the other bone, but I don't think there's any evidence about it. But absolutely, when the bone is fully healed at 3 to 6 months, there is no difference in the strength of one bone versus another. No difference. So now, let me give an exception.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's metal put into bone, rods and pins and screws. I fractured my ankle a couple of years ago, and I've got rods and pins and screws, and I went to Tibet, and I was hiking. Mm-hmm. I was sometimes walking for 10 hours at a time, and I talked to my good friend, the orthopedic surgeon, and I said, do you think this ankle is weaker? You know, is it weaker because it fractured? Mm-hmm. And he said, no, he thought it was probably stronger because you've got metal in there in addition to normal bone.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So if you've got metal in your ankle or in your joint in addition to the normal bone, then that bone is probably stronger from the metal and not from the calcium.
Do you have a myth for Zorba or just a bone to pick? Send your questions along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. That's 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener, joins now from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Tom.
What's up?
Well, I would like some more information about anti-inflammatory diets, if they would help some of my conditions, and how do I know what foods are anti-inflammatory and which ones are inflammatory?
So, which book did you read, or where have you heard about anti-inflammatory diets?
There's a website called Nutrition Data. There's someone named Monica Rheingold. She evidently put together, looked at 20 different nutrients and assigned an index, kind of like a glycemic index, to a whole bunch of foods.
Does she sell anything on the website?
Yeah, I think she does have a book, yes.
Yes, 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 of course. So you always have to look at that. You always have to question when you're looking at information, what are they selling? Now, there's nothing wrong with paying for information. People come into my office and they pay for information every day. But, you know, it's up front and they're paying me with a deductible or their insurance. And if I'm selling a book, well, you know, do I have a proprietary interest in the book? Sure, I want to have the book. So you always have to think about it. And people write books also because they have a passion or they've done some research. There are a lot of reasons behind that. And I've read a little bit about these, as I say, anti-inflammatory diets. And I don't think there's any scientific data behind them at all. Now, I want to go to the glycemic index for an example. I think the glycemic index and the people who wrote books at that actually had a really good point, that when you eat processed foods and sugars and all of a sudden there's a spurt of blood sugar in your body, so your pancreas has to come in and work, that turns out to have some good scientific basis. And we know that eating refined sugars appear to be more likely to produce diabetes than eating, we'll say, carbohydrates that are less refined. A whole potato being much better for you than a mashed potato, an apple with the skin on it, and eating the apple in the bulk being better for you than drinking apple juice. And so that data has panned out. But this idea about inflammation, and we know inflammation plays a role in heart disease and in arthritis and other things, there's no scientific evidence that I've ever found that changing your foods will make a difference. Now, changing your foods so that you eat less animal fat and you're eating a better diet makes a difference, but I'm not convinced that the anti-inflammatory diets do anything. And so I can't give you a list because I don't believe in it. That's my best advice.
But if I just, a vegetarian diet maybe a little better than one
that. Well, we know that that on the whole, a more vegetarian diet, as long as it has enough protein, and a vegan diet is really ultimately optimal. And if you're going to eat animal-based diet, reduction of animal fats is also optimal. And that's kind of my religion.
So go with glycemic index.
That's what I would do. And more vegetarianism within your diet, for sure.
Okay.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
And Zorba, before we take off today, it's time to prepare yourself for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Today's rebuttal comes to us from Neil in Madison, Wisconsin, and is anything but sugar-coated. He writes, I wanted to correct you about the definition of licorice. On a recent show, you talked about the differences between red and black licorice, but there is no such thing as red licorice. Licorice is a flavor. Just because it comes in a long, twisted string does not make it licorice. They are really just red twists. I love listening to your show, but please help me stamp out this misconception.
Well, good luck on stamping it out. He's 100% correct, and yeah. I do know that because I did some research on licorice a couple of years ago and issues with eating too much of it. Then there's real licorice and fake licorice and the black licorice. In other words, there really can be licorice, and then there's artificial flavoring for licorice. Nonetheless, within our normal parlance of regular society, people call red licorice, even though it's a misnomer. And my recommendation is to write the red licorice people and say, please call this red candy twists and stop using the word licorice.
Good
and
luck,
then
too.
It'll stamp out. But you know what? This is one particular protest I shall not herald.
If you think Zorba's advice seems twisted, send your disagreement along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We will see you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor and Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show was produced by Todd Witter with help from Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1201Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.